Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us this morning. My name is Frederick Harper of the Program Training and Consultation Center. I will be moderating today's special webinar on smoking cessation in Ontario, what the Ontario Tobacco Survey tells us. If you are having trouble logging on to the webinar via Microsoft link, please call the 1-800 number for PTCC. The number is 1-800-363-7822, and someone will be able to help you. As a backup for this webinar, all participants were sent a PDF handout of the presentations slides yesterday. If you are having trouble viewing our webinar application, but you can still hear us, please use the PDF handout of the slide presentations to follow along. For many who are logged to the webinar this morning, you will see the presentation on your right. On your left side of the screen will be a chat box. This box is made public to everyone, so whatever you write will be posted and viewable by all those in the webinar, as well as me and our presenters. Feel free to enter any questions in this box, and we will try to address as many as possible during the Q&A sessions at the end of some of the presentations. A reminder that we are recording this webinar, and this recording will be posted on the PTCC website following this webinar. It will probably be as well on the O2 website. We have over 100 participants, so we muted all lines. And so in the various sections where we have the questions and answers, to unmute, you just press star seven. Now to our speakers for this morning's webinar. Dr. Michael Shayton is an assistant professor at OTRU in the Dalhousie School of Public Health at the University of Toronto and co-head of the Population Research Initiative on Mental Health and Addictions at OTRU. His work is focused on the social and psychosocial factors influencing tobacco use from a population health perspective. At OTRU, he is the project lead for the Ontario Tobacco Survey and is the principal investigator of the CIHR-funded study on policy options for addressing tobacco retail availability. Laurie has a master's degree in health studies from the University of Waterloo and has been a research officer at the Ontario Tobacco Research Unit for over 9 years. For the last 7 years, Laurie has been the principal project coordinator for the Ontario Tobacco Survey, a large longitudinal study of smokers and cross-sectional study of non-smokers across Ontario, that some of which we will be talking about this morning. And Laurie's primary research interests include both smoking cessation and general survey methodology. And later, Laurie will be presenting on young adult smoking cessation and what predicts success. Graham is a research officer at OTRU. He received his Master of Science in Community Health and Epidemiology from Queen's University. His thesis work focused on the relationship between neighborhood street connectivity and both physical activity and injury in Canadian youth. At OTRU, Graham's work is on a number of projects, including the Ontario Tobacco Survey and a CIHR-funded study on policy options to reduce tobacco retail availability. He is also involved with the Population Research Initiative on Mental Health and Addictions. And later, Graham will speak on the use of contraband tobacco and its association with poorer smoking cessation. The last speaker will be Bo, who is a senior research officer with OTRU. Bo received her master's degree in public health from Adelaide University, Australia. Currently, she is a PhD candidate in epidemiology, Dalhousie School of Public Health, University of Toronto. Her research interests include the epidemiology of tobacco use, the impact of tobacco policy on health, the role of tobacco in mortality and morbidity, and nicotine replacement therapy for smoking cessation in the general population. And Bo will later on speak on the NRT in this presentation. So I will, at this time, turn over to Dr. Shatin to give us his introductory remarks on the Ontario Tobacco Service.
Hi, thank you very much, and good morning. It's great to see so many people here. My role today is really just to introduce the Ontario Tobacco Survey and give a little bit of background on what it is and what we're trying to do with the survey before the other presenters talk a little bit about the content. If you could switch the slide. Smoking and smoking cessation is hard to measure. It's a dynamic chronic condition. It's a complex human behavior that isn't adequately captured by our large health surveys. And in fact, this dynamic, our understanding of the dynamic chronicness of smoking is really, we learn this from the clinical level. The problem, however, is that people involved in clinical trials, or who are actively seeking treatment, are not representative of the general smoking population. And when we're looking at, or when our goal is trying to reduce prevalence overall, what works in this population may not work overall. And we see this by the lack of success, or the limited success we've seen in changing cessation and quit attempts over the past 30 years, despite our efforts at reducing prevalence. OTRU's strategy evaluation monitoring report has found that smokers had only a 1% chance of maintaining a long-term quit success, and that 3 of 5 smokers, in fact, had made no attempt to quit whatsoever. We need to do better at understanding smoking, and there are a number of gaps in most of the smoking cessation literature. The general health surveys, which we rely on, tend to be mainly cross-sectional and involve a limited sample size for smokers with really overly general content to understand the complexity of the behavior. And they make high burden on recall for these smokers, asking them, for instance, to generalize their entire lifetime of smoking behavior, which would be really easy if you were a computer or a robot, but really hard for humans. The longitudinal studies that we do have tend to be mainly clinical, and they tend to have insufficient follow-up, following smokers for a year or less, and with periods of surveys in between the surveys too long apart. There's also limited information on the policies, programs, and interventions and their effectiveness at a population level and the interactions between these potential programs. So the Ontario Tobacco Survey is OTRU's attempt at trying to fill some of these gaps. It's a telephone-based, regionally stratified random sample of Ontario adults. That means it represents the Ontario population and the Ontario population of smokers. But it's also a longitudinal survey of recent smokers, including a cross-sectional component of non-smokers for comparison. It includes, in total, around 4,500 recent smokers and around 3,000 non-smokers. It was designed to capture the smoking dynamics that followed smokers every 6 months for up to 3 years. Each of the lines here represents a different survey. And the start dates were staggered for the smokers, which allowed us to examine smoking both within smokers, but also over time, to get a sense of the changes in the policy environment and how that may have affected smoking behavior. So far, We've published over 17 peer-reviewed publications since the survey finished collecting data in 2011. And several now are under review or ready for submission, including the presentations that you will see today. We've also have a number of different products meant for other audiences other than purely scientific ones. So the presentations today represent some of the basic questions that we're looking to answer in the Ontario Tobacco Survey. Laura Demert will address a priority population, who's quitting and how are they quitting, in young adults in this case. Graham McCready will address one of the factors in contraband tobacco that may be preventing smokers from quitting and may be affecting their chances of success when they do so. And Bo Jang will address the effectiveness at a population level of a nicotine replacement therapy, one of our, at least one of our main tools and aids that we use to help smokers quit. The Ontario Tobacco Survey, I just want to acknowledge, is an initiative of the Ontario Tobacco Research Unit, which receives funding from the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care. And it was developed by the principal investigator team of OTRU, including investigators from the University of Toronto and the University of Waterloo. I think the presentations that you'll see here today are really exciting. I think when they're published and one of them is in press, will make a big splash. And so it's a chance for a bit of a sneak preview of what's upcoming in smoking cessation research. So with that, I'll turn it over to Laurie. So the poll question we have is, for you, what do you think is the most pressing research need regarding smoking cessation in Ontario? Is it understanding priority populations, understanding the quitting process, evaluating the effectiveness of interventions, aids, and policies, understanding the barriers to quitting, or other?
And just a note to select, you can just click on one of the little dots on the left hand, or you have the option not to vote if you'd like to. This poll is open, and it would be great if everyone voted. Just going to give about 5 seconds for everyone to vote here.
So it looks like the big draw here is the effectiveness of intervention in AIDS, and I think we'll see, along with the barriers to quitting. I'm also very excited to see Bo's presentation, which is actually this is part of her thesis work, which she's defending on Friday. It's an interesting. There was a big splash a few months ago about a study that came out of Harvard, which looked at a similar question, but I don't think they had enough information in their study to really address the question properly. So we'll see what Bo has to say.
Thank you, Michael, and good morning, everyone. It's great to have so many people joining us today. I'm going to talk to you today about my research with my colleagues Sue Bondi, Steve Brown, and Steve Mansky, where we were looking at the predictors of young adult smoking cessation. So smoking prevalence has been decreasing across North America. However, smoking rates have remained significantly higher among young adults. Research has shown that young adults do have different personal characteristics and smoking behaviors than their older counterparts. So, for instance, research has shown that young adults are more likely to smoke occasionally, smoke fewer cigarettes a day. They were more likely to try to quit, but they were less likely to use smoking cessation resources than their older counterparts. And I think these points really indicate the need for looking at young adults as a special population. But I think one of the most compelling reasons to focus on young adults is the fact that the earlier a smoker quits, the greater the health benefits obtained. So if we can get and establish a better understanding of young adult smoking cessation and help smokers quit, we can potentially enhance the health of the population and reduce the future healthcare costs associated with smoking. So just I want to quickly give you a quick background on some of the literature on young adult smoking cessation. There have been a number of cross-sectional studies, and these tend to be more recent than some of the longitudinal studies in the literature. However, these studies are designed to only allow for conclusions on associations with behavior change. There are a few key more powerful longitudinal studies on young adult smoking cessation. However, one of the major challenges here is that these studies have very long periods of follow-up. So these tended to range from 3 to 7 years. And so this means that the predictor variables were measured more than 3 years before the reported behavior change. So if you take, for example, smoking dependence or self-efficacy, these factors may have changed over time and are no longer actually relevant to the later behavior being assessed. So the study objectives were to investigate the predictors of smoking cessation behaviors among young adults in a population-based prospective study of smokers. So we obviously compiled data on the from the Ontario Tobacco Survey on respondents under the age of 30. And as Michael nicely summarized for us, one of the key advantages, especially for this study, is that the Ontario Tobacco Survey has very short follow-up periods. So in this analysis, we compiled data on 592 young adult current smokers at baseline with 6 month follow-up data. The outcome variable was young adult smoking cessation behavior. So this was measured as a 3-level ordinal variable. Those who made no attempt to quit during the 6 month follow-up, those who made an attempt that lasted for less than 30 days, and those who sustained their abstinence for 30 days or longer. Guided by the social cognitive theory, we identified 20 predictor variables, and these included personal characteristics, self-efficacy, intention to quit, perception, use of resources, as well as knowledge and exposure. For the data analysis, we began with chi-square tests to look at the association between the ordinal outcome variable, smoking cessation, with each of the 20 predictor variables presented on the previous slide. We then conducted separate multivariable logistic regression models with factors that were associated with the outcome at a level of 0.2 or less. And the first model, we looked at the predictors of making a quit attempt lasting for less than 30 days in comparison to making no attempt to quit. And in the second model, we looked at the predictors of sustained abstinence for 30 days or longer versus making an attempt to quit and making no attempt to quit. All the analyses were corrected for the complex sampling of the Ontario Tobacco Survey and weighted to the Ontario population. Next slide. So I'm going to begin with the study results and just quickly give you an idea of the sample characteristics. So you can see that we had an average age of 23 years with a greater proportion of men. Almost half the sample had gone on to some post-secondary education. The young adults in this sample generally had a low level of addiction with a mean heaviness of smoking index of 2.34. 44% had an intention to quit at baseline, and almost 50% had used some form of smoking cessation resources during the follow-up. So that could have been any self-help materials, behavioral therapies, or pharmacotherapies. Next slide. This graph illustrates the smoking cessation behaviors among young adults. And you can see here that the majority of young adults did not change their behavior during the six-month follow-up. 61% made no attempt to quit. 25% did make a quit attempt that lasted for less than 30 days, and 14% were able to reach 30-day abstinence during the follow-up period. Next slide. This table illustrates the predictors that were associated with young adult smoking cessation behaviors. And you can see here that there were 7 factors that were significantly associated with behaviors, and this included education, heaviness of smoking index, use of resources, support to quit, lifetime number of quit attempts, and perceived addiction. These, in addition to 4 other factors, were associated with the outcome at a level of 0.2 or less. And in addition to age and sex, the 13 factors in the red text in this table were the variables that were entered into the multivariable models. Next slide, please. And this table demonstrates the results of the complex models predicting making a quit attempt and sustained abstinence among young adults. So in model 1, you can see that the predictors of making a quit attempt were having used smoking cessation resources, having made 2 or more lifetime quit attempts, having an intention to quit, and knowledge of smoking cessation resources are beneficial to and compared to trying to quit on your own. In model 2, you can see that the predictors of sustained abstinence, the positive predictors of sustained abstinence were being very confident in your ability to quit, having used smoking cessation resources, and having support to quit. It's not surprising that higher levels of addiction were actually a negative predictor of smoking cessation. Next slide, please. So I just want to make some quick major conclusions from our study. You saw on the previous slide, there are different factors that predict making a quit attempt and sustained abstinence among young adults. And in fact, the only factor that was a significant predictor of quit attempts and cessation, sustained abstinence, was the use of smoking cessation resources. And there was a recent review that concluded that there really is limited evidence of effective interventions for young adult smoking cessation. And I think this really underscores the need for young adult smokers to have a wide range of effective and appropriate cessation resources readily available for them. Additionally, our findings indicate that social support appears to be a very critical piece for smoking cessation in this high-risk population. Next slide, please. Our study obviously has some limitations, and while the Ontario Tobacco Survey has excellent retention rates, we did identify that loss to follow-up was higher among younger adults, and that could affect some of the study power as well as generalizability. Additionally, the Ontario Tobacco Survey does not have factors, have variables in terms of psychological factors or identifying major changes in life events, and these may be particularly salient for the young adult population. Of course, the Ontario Tobacco Survey is a telephone-based survey, so there are some common limitations there, and I'm just going to highlight one that, again, may be particularly important for young adults, is that cell phone-only residences are excluded from the study. Next page, please. So I just want to wrap up here with some thoughts on some areas for future research. And first off, I think we do need to assess the predictors of young adult smoking cessation for longer periods of abstinence and relapse in this group. It would be beneficial to further explore the effects of contextual factors and policy factors and how that impacts this group of young adult smokers. And given that heaviness of smoking index is such a negative predictor of cessation, I think it'd be interesting to explore gradual versus abrupt quitting in this population. can we determine if we can appropriately recommend gradual reduction as an effective cessation strategy for this group of smokers? And perhaps most importantly, we do need to identify effective and appropriate cessation aids and resources for young adults. What are young adults using to make a quit attempt? What are they using to help them sustain their abstinence? Essentially, we need to establish best practices for young adult smoking cessation. And next slide, please. And my acknowledgments here, I'm not going to go through the details because they do reflect what Michael had up previously. So I think I'll leave it there. And does that take us to our next poll question?
I think it does.
So I understand that we have a number of people from a wide range of public health units across the province and other organizations across the province. And so we're just putting it out there, and I know a number of you have already indicated that the need for effective interventions is a research priority. So your question, in my region, smoking cessation programs for young adults are very effective, somewhat effective, not at all effective, non-existent, not relevant to my work, and we'll see how the results come in. Okay, so as you can see, it looks like the majority of people have non-existent programs for young adults, and again, I think that really reflects the need for a specific research priority here, and there seems to be a handful of some effective or somewhat effective programs, and it would be interesting to hear from those of you who do have effective programs, and maybe we can start to build the evidence base for best practices on young adult smoking cessation.
At this point, we open the lines for questions, verbal questions, or if you have any question that you would like to write in the chat box, you can go ahead and do so. If you want to ask a question, please press star 7, and you can go ahead and ask your question.
Thank you for answering that there. It is a measure of, so there's a question about what is HSI online, and it is a measure of nicotine dependence. It's based on a smoker's time to first cigarette in the morning and their number of cigarettes per day, and this generates a score ranging from zero to low of zero to a high of 6.
From Leave the Pack Behind.
Okay, yep. So there's another online question. Did the 30-day sustained abstinence include slips? So a good question, thank you. The 30-day sustained abstinence could include, they had to have been abstinent for a complete 30 days. At the time of the follow-up interview, they may have slipped or even resumed smoking, but during that 6-month window, they did obtain 30 days of abstinence.
Another question from Heather McCauley, and my chat box jumping down, but we go back to that.
So there's a question online. What about ice? Oh, sorry. What about isolating for specific subcultures of young adults? They are having success with the type of approach in parts of the U.S. That's actually an interesting question. At this point, we weren't able to look at different subcultures of young adults, but that would be a really interesting next step. And I don't know if we have we might be able to play a little bit with the sample in the OTS to determine if we have the ability to further explore that. But at this point, we haven't been able to do that, and that's a really good comment.
Okay, another question from Andy.
Okay, does the research give us an indication of whether young adults benefit from existing cessation supports or require different tailored supports? If tailored, what clues does this research give us about what those tailored approaches might be? It's a very good question, and unfortunately, in this analysis, the supports that are identified, the cessation use of cessation resources, is a collapsed variable of any cessation resources. So we do need to determine what young adults are currently using, is it working for them, and do we need new tailored interventions to really help them quit? And I think this needs to be a high priority for future work and future resource, for future research moving forward. At this point, we don't have the answers.
We have another one from Lily.
Okay. Can you please explain the two models of predictors of young adult cessation? That's why I wasn't really clear. Okay, so the first model just looked at predictors of making a quit attempt that lasted for less than 30 days compared to those. So the predictors of a quit attempt are those making a quit attempt for less than 30 days compared to those who did not make an attempt to quit. In comparison, the predictors of sustained cessation was compared to those who either made an attempt that didn't last for 30 days or those who did not attempt to quit. And those models were selected to help ensure independence between the models.
Great. Question about the definition of young adults.
Yes. So young adults were defined as anyone in the Ontario Tobacco Survey who was under the age of 30. So in the Ontario Tobacco Survey, those would be 18 to 29-year-olds. And we have another question. Do you have any stats on the use of online and text messaging support, perhaps from the Smokers Helpline, by young adults? I haven't seen any of that information, Michael or Anne. Do you know if O2 has any stats on that? Okay. So apparently we do, but we don't have it offhand. And
contact thread.
Yeah. If you'd like more information on that, please contact us, and we can see what we can identify for you there. It's a good question, and I think given today's young adults and social media, I think we really have to ensure that we have effective online text messaging supports available to them. Social support is a significant predictor of cessation. Is it enough just to have some virtual online social support that do they need to be a close connection to the person, or can it just be some virtual community that exists?
Mm-hmm. Good.
So we have another question. Could you please explain again the statement that a drawback of most longitudinal studies is that characteristics measured 3 to 7 years before behavior change? That's a very good question. So there's been a number of the longitudinal studies in the literature on young adult smoking cessation have very long follow-up periods, so again, ranging from 3 to 7 years. And so what that means is the predictor variable, I'll call it time one, is measured at time one. And then we don't assess behavior change for 3 to 7 years later at time two. So if you take, for example, smoking dependence or self-efficacy to quit, if that's measured at time one, and then we don't measure your behavior change for another 3 to 7 years, those factors may have changed over time leading up to, say, your actual quit attempt. Those predictors may not actually reflect the measured behavior 3 to 7 years later, since those factors are likely to change before an attempt. So if we can shorten up the follow-up periods, the idea or the hope is that we can have variables that are more reflective of the behavior change that we're looking at. And the final question here is there any research that speaks to coworker or parent support and young adult utilization rates? This is what you mean by social support. In a way, it is what's meant by social support. So social support here is very vague. It's just the respondent's interpretation of, do you have support to quit if you wanted to quit? And so exactly. It could be parental support, family support. Again, could it just be an online virtual community that's enough support for this group of young adults? And I think that really needs to be explored to determine, you know, what they need, what's required, and again, help inform best practices for this group. And I think we have a new question here. If the predictors of quit attempts and sustained abstinence are different, what should be our priority? Increase quit attempts or increase abstinence? What's the correlation between both? That's actually a very, very good question. And I almost question whether or not, you know, I think we need both. Somehow we need to find the right balance. People need to make a quit attempt in order to sustain that abstinence. And the question is, do we need different programming for both if we have different predictors? And I don't think we have the answer yet. And I would argue that we need to balance that appropriately. What the right balance is, I don't know. And maybe some of you out there who have a lot of firsthand experience could comment from your experience what you perceive to be the balance between the two. Is it 50-50? Is it 60-40? I don't know. And I think that's a really important question, and hopefully future research can help resolve some of that.
Do we have time for one more question that just popped up? Or would you like to address this at the end?
I can...
Why did you not drink food free home?
Smoke-free homes was a predictor in the complex models, in the table showing predictors of young adult smoking cessation. It was associated with the outcome at a level of 0.2 or less. It wasn't significant, but it was included in the models because it was associated with the outcome at a level of 0.2. It wasn't a significant predictor. It wasn't a significant predictor of either making a quit attempt or sustained abstinence.
You can introduce Graham.
Right. So we're going to move on to our next presenter, which is Graham McCready, research officer at OTRU.
Okay, hi everyone. My name is Graham. That's my mug that you're looking at up there. I'm going to be talking to you guys today about contraband tobacco in Ontario and how it's associated with poor smoking cessation outcomes. So the objectives for this presentation are twofold. I just want to start out by quickly going over the scope of the contraband problem and what's involved. And as well, I want to talk about obviously how people who smoke contraband cigarettes, whether or not that actually has an effect on their quit attempts and their cessation outcomes. So just to start off, looking at contraband in Canada, the estimates of how much people are actually smoking vary greatly. So specifically for in Ontario, we have estimates ranging anywhere from 14 to up to 40% of contraband as a whole in the tobacco market. So it's a very wide range that we're dealing with. So we don't know exactly how much is being smoked and how much is being purchased. So these cigarettes come from a few main sources. The first is First Nations reserves, and those come from two different sources within that. So first of all, there's illegally manufactured cigarettes. So those are manufactured on reserves without the proper permits and such. And the second is legally manufactured cigarettes that are then illegally diverted to the general population. So there are cigarettes that are manufactured legally on reserves, which are intended for the sale to First Nations people without all the applicable taxes. And these become contraband cigarettes when they're sold to members of the general Ontario population. And the final source of contraband is stolen or counterfeit cigarettes smuggled in from other countries. And one of the main sources of that is from China. So looking at the cost, cigarettes in Canada are subject to a federal excise duty, a federal sales tax, and a provincial sales tax. So if you look at a hypothetical carton of cigarettes priced at $40, it would be subject to an additional $43.50 in taxes, so more than doubling the overall cost of obtaining the product. Now, looking at the price for 200 cigarettes, you can obtain one of those clear plastic baggies of 200 contraband cigarettes for as little as $6, where it would cost anywhere from $75 to $90 or even more to purchase 200 cigarettes at a retail outlet. So you can see that comparatively, the price of contraband is pennies compared to retail. So what we want to know then is whether people that are smoking these extremely cheap contraband cigarettes have a harder time making quit attempts and have a harder time achieving cessation. So to do this, obviously we use data from the Ontario Tobacco Survey, which you've heard a bit about. We use data from 2005 to 2008. And what we did was take the first baseline interview as well as look at two subsequent follow-up interviews at 6 and 12 months. So overall, we had a full year worth of follow-up time. We had just under 2,800 people that met the eligibility criteria for our study, which were they had to have been a self-identified smoker, smoked 100 cigarettes at baseline, and smoked in the past 30 days at the baseline interview as well. So the key exposure for our survey is obviously contraband cigarette smoking, and we obtained that from the OTS by asking people what brand of cigarettes they usually purchase. So we had a list of known contraband brands. So anyone that said that they usually smoked one of those, we classify them as a contraband smoker. Further, anyone who reported normally purchasing their cigarettes on First Nations Reserve, we classified them as contraband smoker as well. So we looked at two main cessation outcomes, those being quit attempts and 30-day cessation. So a quit attempt was simply any self-identified attempt to quit smoking cigarettes during the follow-up period. We also looked at whether the people at the follow-up had said that they were no longer smoking, and we classified them as having made a quit attempt as well, regardless of whether they came out and explicitly said that they made one. And for 30-day cessation, that's simply any quit attempt that lasted at least 30 days in length during the follow-up. So we have a couple limitations to mention for the study. The first is that there's the potential for exposure misclassification. And this would arise due to the fact that contraband cigarettes are, in fact, illegal. So it's possible that people may have underreported the amount of contraband that they were smoking. Also, there's a couple limitations associated with the OTS data. As Laurie mentioned, it is a telephone survey data, so it only applies to people who have a landline at their house, no cell phones. And people have to speak English, and it also skips over some people in institutions such as hospitals or prisons. So moving on to some results, this is just looking at the proportion of people that said they smoked each category of cigarette in our sample. So you can see that 13% of the sample reported smoking contraband cigarettes normally, with 54% and 33% reportedly smoking premium and discount brands, respectively. So what we then did was look at the relationship between these three categories and the smoking cessation outcomes. But we found that premium and discount smokers really didn't have a difference with respect to their quit attempts or cessation. So we decided to combine them into one big reference category. So you have almost 90% of the group smoking either premium or discount cigarettes, and then you have our 13% of contraband smokers that we compare to. So comparing these two groups, we found that contraband smokers were more likely to be older, to be female, and live in a rural area. They generally had lower levels of educational attainment. They were more highly nicotine dependent. They had a higher perceived addiction, and they had no intention to quit smoking cigarettes in the future. So this is the results of our models here. So looking at contraband smoking and quit attempts first. In unadjusted models, which are the black circles on the graph there, at both the 6 month and 1 year follow-up periods, people that smoked contraband were significantly less likely to make a quit attempt. However, after we adjusted these models for important covariates, which you can see along the bottom there, things like age and heaviness of smoking, these models failed to meet the cutoff for standard statistical significance. So now this graph is looking at contraband and cessation. So again, in the unadjusted models, which are the black triangles, you can see that people that smoke contraband were much less likely to report a period of 30-day cessation. However, this time, in the one-year model, once we adjusted for important covariates, we found that people who were smoking contraband were over 30% less likely to report a period of 30-day cessation, and this was a significant finding. So what we then did was look at people who reported smoking contraband over subsequent interviews and looked at their quit attempts and cessation in the 6 months following that. So you can see that people who reportedly smoked contraband on two interviews consecutively were over 30% less likely to make a quit attempt in the adjusted models and over 50% less likely to have a period of 30-day cessation in the adjusted models. So you can sort of start to see the development of a dose response pattern here, where the longer people are smoking contraband, the least likely they are to make a quit attempt and ultimately succeed in quitting. So that brings me to the part of the presentation that is affectionately named, So What? So what does this mean and why is it important? So the bottom line is that contraband smoking has a negative impact on cessation outcomes. So the availability of these extremely low-cost cigarettes in the market may be weakening our public health efforts to reduce smoking prevalence. So we have things put in place like high tobacco prices and taxation. These are things that we know work well to reduce smoking, and contraband is working against these. So in order to optimize the public health benefits of current and future tobacco control initiatives, we need innovative solutions that address the accessibility of contraband in the market. So we need to take further steps in order to reduce how easy it is to obtain these products. So the Framework for Convention on Tobacco Control, or the FCTC, calls for international cooperation in controlling smuggling, legislation to prevent illicit trade of contraband tobacco, and the development of a tracking system to prevent diversion of cigarettes away from the legal distribution system that I mentioned earlier. So any approach that we take cannot rely solely on increased enforcement, as that would likely add to the criminalization of First Nations people. So we need to work with a respectful engagement with these people and these communities and consider tobacco control within the larger public health concerns of First Nations people and of the Ontario population as a whole. So I believe that is it. That's the end of my presentation. And then we have a poll coming up right now. Number three, yeah.
Okay.
So we just want to know, in your region or in your work, whether you guys come in contact with contraband tobacco. So is it a significant problem that you see, a moderate problem, not a problem, or you're not sure? So we'll give you a moment to answer there.
Significant problem.
Okay, so obviously, as we can see from the results here, most of you think that it is a significant problem, which is great. So the more people realize that it is a problem, the more likely we are to have some significant change. So that's excellent. So I believe what we're going to do now is hold questions from my presentation until the end. So I'm going to go ahead and pass it over to Bo, who is going to talk to us about nicotine patches and how they impact smoking cessation in Ontario. So here's Bo.
And good morning, everyone. Today I'm going to talk about part of my thesis, dissertation work, on nicotine replacement therapy and smoking cessation in the general population of Ontario adult smokers. In this presentation, I will briefly summarize my study, which shows that smokers who choose to use NRT were more addicted and less likely to quit smoking than those who didn't use NRT. However, if they stuck with nicotine patches for at least 8 weeks, then they were more likely to quit than those who didn't use patches. In this talk, I will focus on the findings of my study and present the impact of NRT quit aid on smoking cessation by both NRT type and the duration on two different quitting outcomes. The first, I would like to briefly talk about why this study was conducted. Clinical trials have shown that NRT is efficacious for smoking cessation. Currently, there are 5 forms of NRT products available, including gum, patch, inhaler, lozenge, and nasal spray. The most commonly used 2 forms are gum and the patch. And any NRT, meaning that use of any form of these 5 products individually or in combination. According to the 2009 Cochrane Review, all forms of NRT products are efficacious, increased successful quitting rate by 50 to 70%. But if we look at the trials using gum and the patch, we can see that the efficacy is higher among the trials using patch at 1.7, the relative risk, than the trials using gum. The relative risk is 1.4. And this Cochrane review included over 130 trials, over 40,000 participants, and the follow-up mainly ranged from 6 to 12 months. Because most participants in clinical trials received substantial behavior support and they are heavily selected, most of the time they are heavy smokers smoking at least 15 cigarettes per day. So people have questions about the generalizability of clinical trials to the real world, because in the real world, smokers do not receive substantial behavior report. And smokers include both light smokers and heavy smokers in the general population. So to examine the effectiveness of NRT in the general population, several population-based studies have been conducted. A few of population-based studies have shown no impact of NRT or even negative impact of NRT for smoking cessation in the general population. A few others show positive impact of NRT, but mainly in the short and the medium term, up to 6 months. Several population-based studies have indicated that in the general population, smokers don't use NRT correctly. They use either very briefly or for a very short period of time. The median duration of use mainly ranges from 10 to 14 days. But most of previous population studies only examine the impact of NRT for smoking cessation by comparing use versus non-use. They haven't looked at the duration of the use. A recent population-based study by Alpert et al. It's the only population-based study that has assessed the duration of NRT use and smoking cessation. This study has drawn lots of media attention because study has concluded that using NRT, even for more than 6 weeks, has no impact on smoking cessation. However, this study didn't examine NRT use duration best test, and also the sample size in this study was very small. For the group, they used NRT more than 6 weeks. In their 12 stratified analysis, averagely the sample size was less than 10. So, and there hasn't been any population-based study that used a representative sample of smokers examining the NRT impact on smoking cessation by both its type and duration. So, the objective of my study was to examine the impact of NRT quit aids on smoking cessation by both type and duration by comparing using this NRT quit aids for the recommended duration, at least 8 weeks, and the suboptimal duration, less than 8 weeks, to not using them. I used the three types of NRT, including any NRT, using patch, and use gum, because using patch and using gum are the most commonly forms in the general population. Other types of NRT use do not have enough sample size in this study, so it's not checked separately. So similar to other presenters today, I use the longitudinal data from Ontario Tobacco Survey, OTS. This is a representative sample of Ontario adult smokers aged 18 or older. And then I used those smokers who were followed up for a minimum of 3 subsequent interviews at 6 month intervals. And here this slide shows the samples in my study, included in the analysis. Basically, I included those smokers who were baseline current smokers and made a serious quit attempts at follow-up. And I'm also looking at the quitting outcome at the end of 18 months of follow-up. So for the short-term abstinence, defined as continuous quitting for at least 1 month at the end of 18 months, included those approximately 1,600 baseline smokers who made a quitting attempt, and they had at least 6 months of follow-up after they made the serious quitting attempt. Among those, roughly 1,400 smokers were re-interviewed at the end of 18 months of follow-up, so the retention rate was high at 88%. And then for the long-term abstinence, defined as continuous quitting for at least 12 months, including those roughly 1,700 baseline smokers who made a serious quitting attempt, and they had at least 12 months of follow-up after making a serious quitting attempt. Among those, roughly 1,100 smokers were re-interviewed at the end of 18 months, so retention rate was 83%. In the analysis, I used a Poisson regression to examine the association between the use duration of NRT quit aids and smoking cessation, adjusted for all confounding variables. Potential confounders considered in my study included the social demographic factors, tobacco dependence, quitting history and intention to quit, social and environmental factors for quitting, and use of other quit aids. This slide shows the NRT quit aid use patterns. The I guess red part is for those who didn't use any NRT patches or gum. And the yellow bars are for those who use this quit aid less than 8 weeks, and the green bars are for those who use this quit aid for at least 8 weeks. From this graph, we can see that the majority of smokers didn't use any NRT, close to 60%, or patches, 75%, and or gum, 80% didn't use. And only a very small proportion of smokers use this quit aid for the recommended duration of at least 8 weeks. That proportion was 8% for any NRT use, 5% for using patches for at least 8 weeks, and only 3% for using gum for at least 8 weeks. The median use duration was 14 days for using NRT or patches, and 10 days for using NRT for gum use. And this graph shows the quit rate at the end of 8 months. The upper graph is for short-term quitting, and the lower one is for long-term quitting. There is kind of a pattern. We can see that those who didn't use any NRT patches of gum, and those who used those quit aids for at least 8 weeks, had higher quit rate, no matter it's short-term quit rate or long-term rate, than those who used those quit aids less than the recommended duration of 8 weeks. The highest short-term quit rate as found among those who use patches for at least 8 weeks, is 34%, and the lowest is among those who use patches or gum less than 8 weeks, is 19%. The highest long-term quit rate was, again, among those who use the patches for at least 8 weeks, is 13%. The lowest long-term quit rate was among those who used gum for less than 8 weeks, 82%. This graph shows the Poisson regression findings for short-term abstinence by use duration for NRT quit aid. The three blocks, if you can define them. The first four graphs in the first block is for any NRT use. The middle four bars for patch use, and the red four bars for gum use. In the first two bars in each block are for those who use any NRT patches of gum less than 8 weeks, and the red two bars in each block are for those who use this quit aid for at least 8 weeks. And also you can see there's a horizontal line is relative risk 1, that is for the reference group of non-users. The yellow bars are for crude analysis, and the green bars are for adjusted analysis. We can see that almost all yellow bars are lower than the green bars, meaning that those one we didn't control for tobacco dependence or other covariates, they had a lower relative risk to quit than those who didn't use those quit aids. So in study, if they didn't adequately control for tobacco dependence, they would get a wrong conclusion. You know, NRT use may make people less likely to quit. So adequate control for confounding is important. The most important point in this slide is the relative risk is 1.7, I circled in the right. For those who use NRT nicotine patches for at least 8 weeks, the adjusted, if you can see the error bars, they didn't cross the horizontal line. That means those who use nicotine patches for the recommended duration of at least 8 weeks were 1.7 times more likely to quit than those who didn't use patch. But if they use any NRT or gum, even for at least 8 weeks, they didn't reach a significant level of higher likelihood of quitting, even though, you know, they they were higher than those who didn't use, but not significant. Next, please. And also in this slide shows the regression analysis results for long-term creatine. It's end of 18 months. So I use the same color scheme and comparison, everything. So I want to point 2 points here. One is those who use NRT or gum less than 8 weeks were less likely to quit than those who didn't use NRT or gum. So this is more likely. For NRT use, actually, it's more likely due to gum use, because NRT mainly consists of patch and gum use. Another point, more importantly, is those who used patches for at least 8 weeks were more likely, 2.6 more likely to quit than those who didn't use patch. So that's the main point from this slide. Next, so in conclusion, both type and use duration for NRT quitase play important roles in smoking cessation in the general population. Using gum, even for the recommended duration, is not associated with higher likelihood of quitting. Only using nicotine patches for the recommended duration helps smokers quit smoking in the general population. However, because only a small proportion of smokers use NRT, especially patches, for the recommended duration, so more efforts are needed to promote smokers to use nicotine patches for the recommended duration. All channels, avenues, including psycho, telephone, quick lines, web-based programs, advertisement about NRT for quitting, labels on NRT packages, and healthcare practitioners should be used, you know, to promote the use of nicotine patches for at least 8 weeks. And that's the end of my talk. Thank you.
So, time again for questions and answers. If you want to ask a verbal question, please press *7 on your phone. And you can as well write your question in the chat box. We have a question here for Graham. Is there any current research on First Nations interest to focus on health benefits from tobacco cessation versus gaining economic benefits from tobacco industry? What are your thoughts on this subject?
Okay, well, I'm not aware of anything that looks directly at their interest in dealing with the problem. I know it's a very lucrative business for a lot of people on First Nations reserves as it stands. But I would imagine working together with the leadership groups in these communities, there would probably be some interest in getting rid of this problem. That's pretty much all I could say towards that, I guess.
The next question for both is the horizon regression analysis for use of NRT showed best success when used for 8 weeks. However, the provincial allowance is for 5 weeks. Should the province fund an 8-week NRT supply for eligible clients?
That's a great question, actually. Lots of free NRT programs find, you know, different kinds of duration of free NRT are very effective. But I just find a recent study that testing how much free NRT we should provide to smokers, and they found at least 2 weeks should, you know, do some as good as those who provided 8 weeks. But why? Because they only focusing on how many they provided, but rather than how many the smoker will actually use. So if you provide more free NRTs, more likely smokers wouldn't use it. They just pile it somewhere. So based on this study, at least you need to provide 2 weeks. And another difference would be in those free NRT programs, they needed to meet some kind of inclusion criteria. They actually smoke for 10, I believe, most of these free programs. You have to be a daily smoker, smoke at least 10 cigarettes per day. And research has shown that more addicted smokers benefit more from NRT. So that may be the difference. Even, you know, if you provide 5 weeks of free NRTs, you can still see the significant effects among those smokers.
Okay.
There is a comment though from Karen that the provincial restrict an individual to 5 weeks. Rather, the 5 weeks was used as an average course for treatment across all users, and in fact, the Family Health Teams initiative allows up to 20 weeks as needed. So that's another comment to put in the mix. There is a question from Shelley and from Melody as well as to where does counseling programs support for and the support to quit or use of sufficient resources. And then there is one on, do we know why smokers tend to use NRT for much less than the recommended duration?
Counseling program support or fall? That was under.
Yeah.
Oh, counseling. Sorry, counseling programs fall under smoking cessation resources. So any behavioral support, counseling programs, and pharmacotherapy were collapsed under smoking cessation resources.
Example, the second one.
Okay, so do we know why smokers tend to use NRT for much less than the recommended duration? Okay, that's a great question, actually. In our own study, we didn't ask the regions why they didn't use long enough, but as I know, there are two studies at least. They look at the discontinuation from recommended duration. The first, most common region is, I believe, they resumed to smoking again. And the second one is the side effects. So, you know, there are lots of side effects and they just cannot continue using those NRT. And also there are other kind of reasons, including cost. So that's why, you know, free NRT or subsidized NRT should be helpful.
The next question for Graham on contraband is it possible that smokers who choose to use contraband have already chosen not to quit, not the reverse?
All right, so I guess it's true that we can't really say the directionality of the relationship we're looking at, whether people make this decision and then choose to buy contraband. But I think one of the things that we're arguing, I guess, is that the availability of this extremely cheap source of tobacco makes it a lot easier for them to make a decision not to quit. So if they're able to get, say, like I mentioned, 200 cigarettes for $6, that makes it a lot easier to put off quitting or even to relapse once they have already potentially made a quit attempt.
Another one on NRT is how were smokers who use patches and gum classified? And if you add the second one as well, did your study factor in the effects of counseling along with the NRT? Is there any evidence that NRT plus counseling enhances the effect?
In my study, I did look at the potential interaction effect between NRT use and counseling. Unfortunately, not enough smokers have used both kind of quit aids at the same time. It's very low. I believe it concurrent use is less than 2% in this population. So my study's power was not strong enough to detect the potential interaction effect. However, other studies, I believe at least one, did find, you know, both of quitting aids would be more effective than the single one, but I can't remember the reference. But if you want to know the detail, you can email me so I can, you know, contact you.
Okay.
get back to you about the reference.
We have another question here regarding that. Do you have any data on the use of the patch and gum together?
Again, very few use at the same time. It may over the 6 months duration, sometimes they use gum and other times they use patches. The concurrent use is very low. But current guidelines for practice guidelines do recommend that people should use at least two forms of NRT, especially the combination of nicotine patches plus gum or inhaler, because patches can provide low and constant level of nicotine. But if people have cravings for a cigarette, better dealt with gum or inhaler. They can give you a rapid kind of nicotine into your blood. So, you know, combination of use and NRT forms are recommended currently.
And then we have this question about, we are starting to see the Nicorette spray mixed now in TV ads in DC. I know you have not talked about this specifically, but could you comment on the use of this product?
So, what is the product?
It's called
Nicorette Sprayness.
Nicorette
Sprayness. I haven't seen any use in our study. Did you see any?
It's newer, and it would be like the inhaler. It wouldn't show up yet in the population.
Yeah, it's just too soon to see the effect yet. Maybe first would be a clinical trial to show, you know, this use compared to non-use and see the effect. Normally, we see the impact from clinical trials first.
Another question, do you have a table comparing the demographics, characteristics of those who use NRT versus those who do not make a quick attempt?
Not in this presentation. I have a very complicated table in my dissertation. Basically, those who use NRT, smoke more cigarettes per day, have high level of heaviness of smoking index. They made more lifetime quit times. I think they had a lower proportion of home smoking restrictions. It's just the opposite for the smoking cessation outcome. So if you don't control for these confounding variables, you would get a wrong kind of conclusion. Those who, and also I believe there's a few population-based studies did find that those who used NRT were less likely to quit than those who didn't use NRT, but in those population-based studies, they didn't control for tobacco dependence variables.
And there is a statement of fact here from a study in Montreal region among users of quit smoking centers showed that users of NRT had higher chances of quitting smoking without counseling. Mm-hmm. However, counseling was associated with use of NRT beyond 8 weeks. The next question from Grace is, can you explain the process for adjusting the data, that is, what variables were considered? In particular, I'm wondering if those who stuck with the patch for 8 weeks were more motivated to quit.
That's a great question. Actually, in the analysis, I did try to control for motivation. Two questions I used. One is, did you quit because of your health? And another one, let me think. If you think smoking is beneficial for your overall health, I mean, those two questions wouldn't be adequate enough to capture the motivation, but to some extent, it can be used to approximate the motivation. It is true motivation is a stronger predictor for smoking cessation, but one study did show that motivation per se is not adequate enough to make or maintain smoking cessation.
The next question is, I've had some recent success with NRC through the STOP program working with 20, 30-year-old age group. New parents, and the second question is, have recently moved into a professional work environment. Are there studies?
Actually, just to clarify, so working with 20 to 30-year-old age groups who, number one, are new parents, and they have recently moved into a professional work environment.
Mm-hmm.
Are
so there any studies?
Mm-hmm.
And
then
these populations.
On NRT.
Yeah. Are there studies that are looking at NRT use in new parents?
Not as I'm aware. No, I don't think so.
I haven't
seen any study specifically on the new parents. Yet.
Right.
No, I haven't.
Okay, or are people moving on to new jobs?
Not as I myself, no. How about you guys? Have you closed?
I guess the last question, last but one question I should say is, were you able to look at NRT use among young adults in your study?
Unfortunately, the sample size was not large enough to look at among young adults only.
Okay. And the last question is, has there been any research exploring NRT treatments combined with regular exercise programs?
There may be one. I'm not particularly sure. But I did see some studies looking at exercise only. Not quite sure if they would give them NRT treatment as well. Do anyone know?
There are a couple of people working on exercise and smoking cessation. Harry Badly mangling his name, at the University of Western Ontario, who both have a number of different, been involved in a number of different studies, some of which I think have used NRT. It's mixed results, but quite relatively small studies compared to the ones we've looked at here today.
Thank everyone for coming today. I think it's been a really interesting session, and I think there have been a number of really great questions. If you have any further, please either contact us individually or OTRU in general. You can find us on the web at www.otru.org and for other knowledge projects, services, and resources. So thank you very much for coming today.
And I would like to as well thank our presenters today. Please feel free to contact us at TTCC or OTRU for any information about our services and resources. And if your health unit organization would like to host a TTCC training session, we will also be sending you an email with a survey to complete after this webinar. So please feel free to complete and add any comments you would like to help us improve our online training sessions. And again, a good Wednesday to all, and hope to see you at another future PTCC training session. Thank you, and have a great day.
Thank you. Please stand by.